Hello and welcome once again, podcasters, to this series of podcasts brought to you by Kilkenny Library Services in partnership with Kilkenny County Council and the Decade of Centenaries Fund. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these podcasts we focus on revolutionary era Kilkenny. Today I thought we'd reflect on and remember the civilian fatalities of the Irish War of Independence in County Kilkenny. A total of 4 civilians died. There's 3 men and 1 woman who were caught in the crossfire and had no choice in dying for Ireland. The civilian tragedies all took place within the final bloody months of the conflict, from December 1920 to April 1921. Now, there were another 4 people executed by the IRA for informing. Some would argue that these should also be classed as civilian casualties, but today I will just focus on those not directly caught up in the political conflict. The first civilian casualty and the only woman to die as a direct result of the political violence during the Troubles in County Kilkenny was a lady by the name of Margaret Ryan of Callan, and she died in December 1920. Now, her killing was connected to the death of RIC Police Constable Thomas Welsh, who was shot in the aftermath of the Nine Mile House ambush. Now, just to outline what happened there, if you didn't hear of it before, the West Kilkenny or 7th Battalion Flying Column, also known as an active service unit or ASU, ambushed a Crown Force patrol near the village of Nine Mile House, which is just on the Kilkenny Tip border. They were helped by members of the Tip Brigade and regular members of the Callan 7th Battalion as well. The ambush did not exactly go as planned, however, as the soldiers and the RIC came from the opposite direction than was anticipated, and instead of being in lorries, the Crown Forces were on bikes. In addition, one IRA man accidentally fired prematurely before the RIC were properly in the ambush position, so it allowed them to escape and take cover in the fields. Nonetheless, some RIC were wounded, although none fatally, and their bicycles were taken by the IRA, with all the column retreating successfully. Gunfire could be heard that December evening for miles around. It sounded like a mighty big clash. Crown Forces in Callan and Mulnahone immediately telephoned Kilkenny for reinforcements. Closer to Callan, 2 of the ambush party who were on their way home after the ambush, that's Paddy Ryan and Tom Marr, ran into another patrol coming against them, and fire broke out between the two sides. One of the Crown Forces, Private Squibb, was shot in the eye. Although he later recovered, he lost a sight in the eye. Later that evening, another group of police from Kilkenny arrived as reinforcements. The aim was to try capture the IRA, who they believed must still be in the fields or in the area generally. 40-year-old RIC Sergeant Tom Welch was in that group that travelled down from Kilkenny. Unbeknownst to them, soldiers of the Devonshire Regiment, the Devons, were scouring the fields nearby looking for the flying column as well. They would no doubt have been agitated and on tenterhooks, as one of their number had just been shot in the eye just an hour or two previously. In the darkness of what was nearly the shortest day of the year, the Kilkenny RIC, under the command of Inspector White, fired on the Devonshire soldiers in the field, thinking they were the rebels the flying column escaping. The Devons returned fire with their rifles, and it was from this fire that RIC man Tom Welch of Ballyragus was instantly killed, the bullets having hit him in the head. Another RIC constable was hit in the arm. It could be considered a comedy of errors if it wasn't so serious. 2 badly wounded and 1 dead member of the Crown Forces, and yet no rebels caught. The events in and around Nine Mile House made national headlines and even the Times of London, but information was scant but exaggerated, likely to save their blushes, and the IRA are more or less blamed in the media anyway, but not in private, for the death of Tom Welch. The fact that he died at the hands of men on the same side, so to speak, was kept relatively quiet. Welch's remains were brought to the Workhouse Hospital in Callan soon after. Now, on the following evening, that's the evening of the 21st of December 1920, the remains of Tom Welch were due to leave Callan Barracks in a convoy of cars, Crossley Tenders and Lancer armoured cars for their onward journey to his home village of Ballyragus, which is up in North Kilkenny, where his funeral was due to take place. One section of the auxiliaries had warned all businesses earlier in the afternoon to shut up, quench any lights, and civilians were told to stay indoors and off the streets during the procession. Margaret Ryan ran a grocery store and public house with her husband Michael at the end of Bridge Street. The building is still there and people would know it today more so as Horrigan's Pub, which is at the Kilkenny side of Bridge Street near the corner and is much the same as it was 100 years ago. On that tragic evening, Margaret had permitted a customer, Josephine Delaney, in for a jug of milk at around 5:30 p.m. Both women were watching the procession, which included 4 Crossley tenders and a Ford motor car at front from inside the shop. Just then, a shot was fired from one of the passing Crossley tenders of auxiliaries. A shocked Josephine Delaney described later on in the coroner's inquest what happened in those moments. Quote, I was in the tap room, which is next to the shop. I was looking out of the window, watching the funeral of Sergeant Welch, and I saw the hearse go by. The hearse was followed by a small car and some lorries. As the first lorry passed the door, I heard one shot fired. I got down from the window. Mrs. Ryan then came into the tap room. I asked her, did she hear the shot? She said, yes, and I think I've got it through the foot. I asked her, did she fall? She said, yes. She then sat in a chair for a few minutes and then walked into the kitchen and asked for some hot milk. She then went upstairs to her bedroom. All doors had been closed while Sergeant Welch's body was passing through Callan. End quote. Michael Ryan described events from his point of view that day. Quote, I was in the storeroom next to the shop when I heard one shot fired. After coming inside, I asked Miss Delaney who was in the shop at the time and where Mrs. Ryan was. She said she was in the kitchen. I went to the kitchen. She wasn't there. I ran upstairs and found her in her own bedroom, in the bed, in great pain. I asked her what happened and she told me, I think I am shot. I then went over for the doctor and the priest. End quote. The bullet hole was still visible in the shop door for all to see, so it couldn't be denied. The bullet passed through the door and hit Ryan in the abdomen. As she had seen the blood at her feet, she presumed she had been struck in the foot. Dr. P.J. Phelan was called, but her condition deteriorated during the night and she was taken to Callan Workhouse Hospital by her husband. However, Margaret Ryan died there 2 days later on the 23rd of December 1920, making for a very bleak Christmas in the parish and for all involved. The bullets had passed through her bowel and lodged in her back. She was 36 years old. Her death certificate stated she died from an infection following the perforation of the bowel by a bullet. An operation to remove the bullets had taken place, but in a pre-antibiotic era, sepsis could easily take hold, especially when the intestine had been punctured. To add to the tragedy, if all that wasn't enough, Margaret Ryan was also pregnant with her second child at the time of her death. Michael and Margaret Ryan had been married since 1911, having met when she started work as a barmaid on Bridge Street. Margaret's maiden name was also Ryan. The Ryans had not been actively involved in Sinn Féin and the Crown Forces had frequented their pub on occasion. In the aftermath, the RIC and military called on relatives and sent tokens of sympathy. Margaret Ryan's death was very embarrassing for the British authorities. Over the course of the following months, three different inquiries were held into the circumstances surrounding her death. The files relating to this incident generated the largest volume of paperwork of any single event of the War of Independence in County Kilkenny, which shows some inside the British administration were trying to get to the bottom of it, or at least at a minimum, at least attempting to discipline the trigger-happy man who fired the fatal shot. Margaret Ryan's death was also mentioned in an IRA propaganda pamphlet entitled Statement of Atrocities on Women in Ireland. It was produced by Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, that's the widow of Francis, for her tour of America in 1921. The purpose of the tour was to highlight the outrages or violence committed as a result of the British military campaign in Ireland. Under the heading Wanton Terrorism of Young Mothers, Sheehy Skeffington stated, quote, all traders, that's in Callan, were ordered to close their premises during the funeral as a form of compulsory mourning and trade reprisal. Mrs. Ryan ventured to open her door to let out a friend and was instantly shot. It was within a few months of her pregnancy confinement. End quote. Although not totally accurate in its detail, it nonetheless highlighted how an event in rural Kilkenny could be used for publicity purposes to garner support for the cause on the other side of the Atlantic. This was, of course, of little consolation to the relatives of Margaret Ryan and her family. In the aftermath of Ryan's death, an unease can be observed between the local RIC and the auxiliaries. It shows that not all wings of the Crown Forces sung from the same hymn sheet. The local Kilkenny RIC seemed to be embarrassed and angry about what had occurred. Constable Gilday from Kilkenny City RIC, who was travelling in a Ford motor car near the front of the convoy with Michael Welch, and he's the brother of a deceased RIC man, entirely disassociated himself from the actions of the auxiliaries. He stated in the inquiry, quote, I could see no reason for shots having been fired, end quote, squarely saying the auxiliary who fired was totally in the wrong. At the inquest, Dr. Phelan, who had visited Ryan after she was shot and later performed a surgery to remove the bullets, even produced that same said bullet at the inquest, so there was no denying what type of ammunition it was. there had been a story put about and mentioned at the inquest that the bullet could have been fired by somebody who was firing on the cortege and accidentally hit Ryan, but eventually this was discredited. Eventually, the Crossley Tender motor lorry, where the shot most likely originated, was identified. The auxiliaries in this vehicle were from J Company and were not based in Kilkenny, but were originally based in West Cork. They had temporarily been posted to Thomastown, where they took over the workhouse there. It's likely Kilkenny was feeling the heat in those weeks in December 1920, as Ernie O'Malley was caught just 2 weeks before in Inistigue, and Kilkenny appeared to be some IRA hotbed. J Company auxiliaries were obviously sent to enforce a bit of law and order using their own particular methods. Surprisingly, even the Kilkenny auxiliaries in A Company, who were based out of Inistigue and who made up three vehicles in the convoy, disassociated themselves entirely from the actions of their colleagues in J Company. They even went as far as saying it was not A Company who had ordered the shops to close. Their captain stated to the inquiry, quote, "I can personally vouch for the fact that no shots were fired from any vehicle of our convoy, that's A Company, nor were we aware of the order that all doors were to be closed when the cortege passed through." End quote. Pressure was placed on J Company from the British military headquarters in Dublin and in Cork to assist in their investigation. The British military authorities in Cork also endured delays in obtaining responses from the auxiliary commanders in J Company. In April 1921, J Company auxiliaries sent the following to the military commanders, quote, "There appears to have been some difficulty owing to the move of the auxiliary J Company, first to Cork and then to Macroom. Also, the officer at these headquarters who dealt with the matter has now been transferred. The delay is much regretted, but all steps are being taken to clear the matter up as soon as possible." End quote. Eventually, a third inquiry was proceeded with in Victoria Barracks, that's now Collins Barracks, in Cork in May 1921, where, for the first time, a member of J Company, W.S. Adams, gave evidence. He contradicted the previous inquiries by stating that the shot was not fired from their motor tender. He was therefore absolving his company from any blame. However, he provided no evidence to back up to his claim. Consequently, as the visiting J Company did not show any evidence to verify that their weapons had not been discharged during the funeral, unlike Kilkenny auxiliaries in the RIC, it must be assumed that someone in their tender was the most likely perpetrator. It may have been just a trigger-happy or nervous young soldier, but it led to the death of a young woman. It was quite common that they'd protect their own, and the auxiliaries were somewhat of an outlier anyway in terms of Crown Forces command structure and acted largely independently. Thus, nobody was held responsible for Margaret Ryan's death. All three inquiries found that the deceased died as a result of a wound caused by a .45 revolver bullet by a person unknown. Margaret Ryan was also very unfortunate in the turn of events. All lights in the street in Callan and in Ryan's shop were extinguished that evening. Therefore, the perpetrator was firing into relative darkness, which would have made aiming at his target difficult, although it's a tight street and he would have been at very close range. The probable offender was also based in West Cork, where just a few weeks earlier, 17 of his comrades in the auxiliaries were killed in the Kilmichael ambush. Auxiliaries were also chiefly responsible for the burning of Cork City in the same month as Ryan's death. Hence, J Company of the auxiliaries were battle-hardened and more trigger-happy, safe in the knowledge they would be protected by their superiors for any repercussions that may follow. The Ryan family received no justice, however. Michael and Margaret had been married in Callan in 1911. She was a barmaid initially on Bridge Street. Obviously, love blossomed then, and she married Michael and into the pub. She became adept at managing the business. Margaret and Michael already had one child at the time of her death, Bridget Mary, who was nearly 5 when her mother was killed. Margaret was originally from Knockfoon, Kilcommon, County Tipperary. After Margaret's tragic passing, Michael later remarried Catherine Neary and had 2 more children, but tragedy struck yet again. In 1926, aged just 48, and 5 years after Margaret's death, Michael Ryan himself died of heart disease and a possible clot. But anyway, on Christmas Day 1920, Callan must have been a very bleak place. During the afternoon, on what should have been a joyous day, especially for 4-year-old Bridges, the funeral of Margaret Ryan took place. She was buried in Tullam Main Cemetery on Christmas afternoon. On the centenary of her death, Callan Heritage Society honoured the memory of Margaret Ryan by unveiling a plaque and placing a reed at the scene of her tragedy at Horrigan's Pub, formerly Ryan's of Bridge Street, Callan. Now, the next civilian fatalis who we touched on in a previous podcast, Thomas Dullard, was caught in the crossfire of the ill-fated Ferry Street ambush on the 21st of February 1921 in Kilkenny City. It was recorded at the time and since that he was killed accidentally by a ricochet bullet. However, recently released documents that were composed by the British military at the time confirmed that Dullard was shot intentionally by members of the Crown Forces, as it was believed he was one of the IRA ambushers trying to escape. Corporation worker Thomas Dullard from Walken Street was leaving the Friary Church after his usual morning prayer on his way back to work. It really was the definition of wrong place, wrong time. Upon leaving the church, he saw two IRA men, that's Tom Hennessy and Michael Darmody, attacking two military officers at the rear of a military convoy. He ran down Friary Street towards High Street to get away from the shooting which was happening just in front of him as he was leaving the chapel. Seeing him running away, Private Gay and Private Hawthorne opened fire on Dullard, thinking he was one of the IRA party escaping. Dullard received an atrocious wound to the head. In the private military inquiry that was held the following day, Hawthorne stated, quote, "While the fray was going on, there was a good many people in Friary Street, men, women and children. They all started running, and after they got clear, a civilian man suddenly appeared about 25 yards away, as if he had just come out of a house. He ran away and several shots were fired at him, including one shot fired by me. The man fell. I thought he was one of the attacking party. I did not hear anyone call him to halt." End quote. A Capuchin friar, Father Patrick, was allowed to come out to give last rites to the injured men, including Dullard. Dr. John Mitchell, whose surgery was on Friary Street, came out and bandaged Dullard's head wound as best he could. He received a rifle butt to the head for his troubles, which left a scar for life, as the Devon soldiers initially thought he was an IRA man giving first aid. Dullard, along with the two IRA men, were brought to the military barracks by military ambulance. Dullard died there, however, just an hour later. Private Hawthorne, in explaining the events of that morning, was unsurprisingly defending himself and his colleagues to their superiors. He was clear in stating that the women and children had left the scene before shots were fired. This would have been difficult to ascertain, considering the events took place within seconds. In addition, no one called on Dullard to halt. This was the usual protocol used by Crown Forces before firing was supposed to commence. In the official statements released by the military in the immediate aftermath of the Friary Street ambush, they maintained it was a ricocheted bullet off a wall that killed Dullard. They also attempted to discover if he had any links to the ambushers. A journalist from the Kilkenny Moderator newspaper described in graphic detail the events leading to civilian Thomas Dullard's death. Quote, "Poor Dullard, when passing, went into the Friary Church for a moment, as was his custom whenever he went that way. He had just come out when firing commenced. Naturally, he became very frightened and commenced to run. The first house that was open and which the poor fellow could have sought safety was Alderman John Slater's house, but within only a couple of paces from the door of that house, he fell mortally wounded, a large portion of his skull having been blown away. A downpipe on the wall at the spot where he fell was pierced by a bullet, and the window sash in Mr. O'Reilly's house also bears the mark of a bullet. Another civilian, who it is stated was on the street at the same time and might be said to be in the same category as Dullard, here he means a young man fleeing from an ambush site, rushed inside a small shop on the opposite side and escaped without hurt." End quote. On Tuesday morning, 22nd of February 1921, less than 24 hours after her husband's death, Bridget Dullard, née Nolan, was required to give evidence in the barracks at a private military inquiry. Bridget and Thomas had five children, ranging in age from 6 months to 15 years old. These were Bridget, aged 15, Stacia, aged 11, Case, aged 5, Nicholas, aged 2, and Thomas, aged 6 months. The couple also had lost two babies in infancy in previous years. Coincidentally, Bridget's mother, that's Thomas's mother-in-law, lived on Pennyfeather Lane beside the fiery, not 50 yards from where he lay dying. Bridget Dullard gave the following account to the inquiry. Quote, "Yesterday, at about 1:30 p.m, in consequence of information received, I came to Kilkenny Barracks and saw the dead body of my husband, Thomas Dullard, at the hospital. At 9 a.m. yesterday, he had his breakfast with me at our house on Upper Walken Street and went off to his work at about 9:30 a.m. I did not see him alive again. He was 37 last July. We have five children, the eldest girl of 15. She's a delicate girl and lives at home and not able to work, having suffered from hip disease. He had nothing to do with Sinn Féin." End quote. It is quite clear from her testimony that she had no choice but to very quickly come to terms with her husband's unexpected death and start to fight for the livelihoods of her children in the form of some form of compensation. Thomas had been the only breadwinner in the household. Ironically, considering how he met his end, Thomas had been a member of the British Army in Ireland up until 1908 before being honourably discharged. In addition, the Dudard family had experienced the loss of Thomas's brother, that's Nicholas, a member of the Leinster Regiment, who died from wounds received at Ypres in 1915 during the First World War. Bridget Dullard had initially requested £2,000 compensation, that's about €130,000 in today's money, from the Crown Forces in compensation for her husband's death. The Crown Forces dismissed this. They said his death was accidental and it was a ricocheted bullet and couldn't be helped. A case was later brought against Kilkenny County Council. They said the responsibility was with the British government, whose army had killed her husband, and this was also dismissed. The Crown Force military never accepted responsibility for Dullard's death, having been caught in the crossfire, with one of their key findings of the inquiry stating, quote, that the said deceased, Dullard, was himself to blame inasmuch as he ran away from the scene of an ambush. It is difficult to understand or ascertain how else they expected a person to react when faced with an ambush situation, running hastily being the most obvious response. Bridget had a few sad years ahead of her. Their daughter, also Bridget, who we mentioned previously, who had been described as also delicate in the inquiry, died 3 years later in 1924 from TB, aged just 18 years. Bridget herself died just 10 years after Thomas in 1931 from kidney failure. A very sad story all around there. Now, it was a similar case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time for 23-year-old James Hoban from Glendonnell, Mullinavass. He was not a member of Sinn Féin or the local IRA as far as we know. On Tuesday the 19th of April 1921, he was in the village of Mullinavass in South Kilkenny with his uncle James Welch selling pigs. Most likely the pigs would have been transferred to the Denny factory or other bacon factories in Waterford City, often by train. Waterford was then the hub of the pork industry in Ireland at the time. On the same day, however, a large military presence was positioned outside Mullinavass RIC barracks as General Strickland, who was in charge of the military in Munster, Kilkenny and Wexford, was visiting the barracks. So he was one of the most senior ranking British Army officers in the whole of Ireland at the time, let alone Kilkenny or the south of Ireland. At around 11:30 a.m, bullets were fired from the turrets of a Rolls-Royce armoured motor car. At least 3 rounds were fired, if not more. Hoban, who was 100 yards down the street, standing next to his uncle, fell wounded. They had been standing near MacDonald's public house, where the farmers would often meet to conduct their business. Hoban had been hit a number of times in both legs, around the thigh area, and was bleeding profusely. Some of the soldiers came down the street and attempted to administer first aid by bandaging James's wounds. His uncle, standing beside him, had miraculously escaped injury, but later said, "When the military came up to help, I went away. I'm over 70 years of age and was overcome by the shock of seeing my nephew lying wounded on the ground," end quote. The soldiers then lifted Hoban, with the help of his cousin Michael Hoban, to nearby Costello's grocery shop on the main street in Mullinavass. He was fully conscious at this stage, and when his sister Anastasia arrived, he told her he was all right. His condition soon deteriorated over the next hour, however, and he was transferred by military ambulance to the Waterford Infirmary. Hoban passed away there later that evening at around 7 p.m, likely due to the amount of blood he had lost. He was buried in Mullinavass graveyard in the plot of his mother's family, the Welches. The soldier who had discharged the weapon which led to Hoban's death, that's Private McCullough, was subsequently court-martialed. McCullough refused to give evidence or cooperate in any way with the inquiry, however. Nevertheless, despite this, he was found not guilty of Hoban's death, as the machine gun's fuse spring was considered too light and the smallest amount of pressure would have left off a few rounds. It was therefore considered an accidental killing. On the 100th anniversary of his death in April 2021, a commemoration was held with his descendants in attendance, and that was organised by Sean Marr. Now, that week in April 1921 turned out to be a very bad week in Kilkenny. Just 2 days after the Mullinavass tragedy, another sad incident occurred, this time in the far north of the county near the village of Ballyragus. Thomas Phelan, who was 18 years old, departed his house in the townland of Old Town on the morning of Thursday, the 21st of April, 1921, to purchase a newspaper in Ballyragget Village. Usually Thomas would have been helping his brother Michael on the family farm, but he had been confined to bed with the flu, and this was his first time out of the house in nearly a week. Michael was a lieutenant in the local Ballyragget IRA, while Thomas was also a member, and that's G Company of the 3rd Kilkenny Battalion. Upon Thomas's return from Ballyragget that afternoon, just around 5 o'clock, he saw two RIC men and two soldiers from the Devonshire Regiment in the field near his house. They had been somewhat expected, as during the previous days, the local IRA had trenched the road and felled a number of trees in the vicinity in order to impede the military movements in the area. Trenching and cutting down of trees to annoy and block the Crown forces was very common at this stage of the War of Independence, and the IRA, the length and breadth of the county and the country beyond, would have done this quite regularly. The main road near the now defunct railway bridge near Old Town had been blocked. Thomas was walking on the path home through the fields. When he saw the Crown forces and they spotted him, he decided to make a run for it. He dropped his bicycle and ran through the fields in order to evade possible arrest or, most likely, being forced to cut the trees from the road. Crown forces would usually round up the young men living near a roadblock area in order to get them to cut the trees out of the way. It was a fairly physical and hard job, remember, to cut a tree back then with just a two-man cross saw to hand. No electric chainsaws in those days. Thomas attempted to run towards the fields at the rear of his house, at which point the soldier shouted at him to stop. He failed to halt, and the two soldiers, Private Davis and Private Humphreys, fired six shots at him from about 100 yards, upon which Thomas fell on a lane behind a ditch he had just got through. One of these bullets had hit Thomas in the back and passed through his abdomen and out the other side. Private Davis described what happened next, quote, "I then climbed through the hedge and found him lying in the pass on his stomach and trying to raise himself up with his hands. We spoke to him here, but he did not answer, and then rolled over and expired at once." End quote. In the meantime, Thomas's mother, Margaret, had come out of the house, which was about 200 yards from where Thomas fell, and pleaded to RIC Constable Patrick Egan to stop the pursuit of her son. Constable Egan was living in the area and was known to the family, however, it was too late. Thomas's body was taken by the military to Castlecomer Barracks for an inquest before being returned to the family. The belongings he had on him at the time were also given back. They included one packet of Player's cigarettes, a watch and chain, a penknife, a notebook, a handkerchief, bicycle clips to stop his trousers getting oily, two pencils, and a copy of that day's Irish Independent, which Thomas had gone into Ballyragget for on that ill-fated day. Thomas was the youngest of four children, and his father, John Phelan, had tragically died when Thomas was just 2 months old from suspected TB, aged just 62 years, and that was back in August 1902. The findings recorded in Thomas's death certificate stated the usual, that he died from shock and hemorrhage caused by a gunshot wound fired by the military in the execution of their duty, end quote. Thomas was not forgotten on the centenary of his death. Although restricted because of COVID regulations, members of the Ballyragget Town Development Association, the Ballyragget Heritage Group, and the family of the late Thomas Phelan unveiled two plaques in his memory. One is in the village of Ballyragget and the other in his home place of Old Town. Now, I think it has been good to remember and commemorate those who died in the line of fire during the War of Independence. They were often only remembered by their families, having kind of fallen between two stools. If they died as members of the Crown Forces, they would be remembered amongst the fallen, and their families would have received some sort of compensation. If they had died as IRA men in an attack, they would have been remembered as heroes, and their families would have eventually received some sort of state compensation. In some ways, their memories rested in some kind of limbo or no man's land. Thankfully, in these centenary years, local groups and their descendants have rectified that. I think that's where we leave it today, just to thank you all again for listening once again. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the amazing free resources on offer there. Until next time.